Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. Wyoming National Guard whistleblowers are saying they got retaliated against for trying to go down the official channels of reporting sexual harassment and workplace hostility complaints.
I just cannot believe this is happening. But I report a sexual assault and now I'm being punished.
Much of the water in the West is already designated in a deal that was made when there was a lot of precipitation.
The problem that we've encountered is since around the year 2000, we've mostly been in water deficit conditions.
And a climbing project outside the Wind River Indian Reservation is years into planning. But the tribes don't feel like they've been brought to the table. Plus, an interesting conversation on the issue of missing and murdered Indigenous women. Those stories and more are coming up on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. Over the last decade, multiple federal oversight decisions and testimony of women points to a problem in the Wyoming National Guard. The issue is the alleged mishandling of sexual harassment and workplace hostility complaints. A joint investigation with WyoFile shows that the Guard has dodged Equal Employment Opportunity Commission rulings concerning cases women have brought forward from their own experiences. Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudowska reports, victims of discrimination are turning to the legislature in hopes of implementing oversight to ensure complaints are handled properly.
For Jenny Rigg, serving your country is a very important value. Every generation of her family since the Civil War has been in the military service.
So when the opportunity came for me to serve in a civilian way, because I've had seven knee surgeries, I jumped at the chance.
Rigg had the opportunity to support those in the military as the Director of Psychological Health at the Wyoming Air National Guard.
Of all the things I've done in my career, that was the thing that made me most proud, is just being able to care for my job was really to care for the health and well-being of the airmen.
More specifically, her job was to provide counseling for the airmen. That's a term for men and women in the Air Guard. Rigg dealt with issues from marital problems to post-traumatic stress and suicide. She also helped file reports of sexual harassment, assault, and discrimination, among other violations. And this is where she says the problem started.
The wing commander told me, "Jenny, I have serious doubts about you. You are like Chicken Little. Everything is always an emergency. If you don't stop this, I will get rid of you."
Rigg says she couldn't stop. It was part of her duty. And in her opinion, the numbers of sexual harassment cases were out of control and something needed to be done.
I kept reporting, you know, there's a problem here. We have a real problem with sexual harassment. And you know, we have got to get our arms around these issues.
But the interaction with the commander got even worse when she reported her own experience with sexual misconduct. In response, Rigg says the commander questioned her judgment, decision-making abilities, and alcohol use. In Rigg's opinion, she was facing retaliation.
I just cannot believe this is happening. But I report a sexual assault, and now I'm being punished. I mean, I could not believe what was happening.
Rigg says she was put on preventive health leave. When she returned to work, she says all her responsibilities were taken away from her. All she could do was sit in her office. And the worst part for her was knowing there were airmen that needed her support.
Trying to help them get the support that we have promised them is available. And it's shut off. I mean, there is no help for them anymore.
So she decided to file a complaint with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. That's the federal authority charged with investigating employer discrimination. The EEOC upheld her complaint and ruled a directive for corrective action. The Guard still has yet to comply with that action and will not comment on Rigg's case. And Rigg's EEOC complaint isn't the only time that the Guard has ignored the federal authority's rulings. In the past decade, there have been two other similar EEOC complaints regarding workplace hostility and retaliation, as well as sexual harassment. One case was resolved, and no action has been taken on the other.
If they don't have harsh consequences, then the message that it sends the military and the men in the military is they can do whatever they want to women and there won't be any consequences for them.
That's Marilyn Burden. She served in the Wyoming Air National Guard for 17 years. She left because of what she calls toxic culture. Wyoming Adjutant General Gregory Porter responded by saying they do take these issues seriously.
We do not shy away from accountability. Nothing destroys trust, breaks teams, or corrodes our warrior culture as do issues of sexual harassment and sexual assault. It cannot be covered up. It cannot be ignored.
And he urged people to report any instances of wrongdoing. But Marilyn Burden and many others interviewed say there's no point in filing a complaint within the current system. So she and others have turned to the state legislature to make a change. Burden says state lawmakers need to hold the Guard accountable, since they can make sexual harassment within the Guard a crime.
I'm requesting this legislative oversight because what we have going on and the people that we currently have in power are not doing the things that need to be done.
Cheyenne Senator Anthony Bouchard has taken up this cause. He hosted news conferences in August where he said the legislature needs to keep the Guard accountable. The issue has been brought to the attention of the legislature's Transportation, Highway, and Military Affairs Committee. Casper Senator Bill Landon is the co-chair of that committee.
Well, it was not a priority because, honestly, we had some other things in front of it, including the Oregon Trail cemetery issue for the military. But we did include it as a list item for which that we would hear a report on rules and regulation changes at the meeting coming up in November.
He says, unfortunately, making and changing laws can be a slow process. And this year is a budget session, which requires any non-budget bill to get two-thirds of support before it can be introduced. Landon says, at the very least, they want to discuss the issue with National Guard officials next month.
If this is an issue that warrants, you know, depending on what we hear and what comes to the committee, it might very well end up as an interim study for next year.
For Jenny Rigg and the other women, they won't be happy until more oversight has gone into effect. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Camila Kodalska at the Center of the West in Cody.
A more detailed account of this story is available in WyoFile. A tiny but growing number of professional sports teams are requiring fans to get vaccinated before they attend home games. They include the NFL's Las Vegas Raiders. But as the Mountain West News Bureau's Nate Hedgie reports, diehard fans in Sin City are split on the mandate.
It's an autumn weekend in Las Vegas, which means lots of sun, lots of tourists, and on a recent Sunday, tens of thousands of football fans. The fans include Isabel Gonzalez from Long Beach, California. She's wearing a black and white Raiders jersey, and she's psyched about this afternoon's game against the Miami Dolphins.
I'm going to be able to scream and sweat and, you know, without having to have a mask over my face.
That's because she's fully vaccinated, and so is almost everyone else in the stadium. The Raiders are requiring all fans 12 years or older to show proof of vaccination at their home games.
To be frank, we did it because we thought it was the right thing to do.
That's team president Dan Ventrelli. The Raiders have taken one of the toughest stances on COVID-19 in the league. Unlike the Seattle Seahawks or the New Orleans Saints, fans can't just show a negative COVID test. They have to be at least partially vaccinated to get in. And fully vaccinated people don't need to wear a mask. Ventrelli says the goal was to keep the stadium at full capacity and to keep fans safe.
To make sure that you didn't have to worry about your health or the person sitting next to you or have any concern about whether the building was a safe environment.
The move was a gamble, and Raiders gave season ticket holders a choice. You could get vaccinated or get a refund or roll your tickets over to next year. About 700 fans refused a vaccine, but since then, others have filled their place. The indoor stadium seats about 62,000 people, and it's sold out for the first game, and it's mostly full for the Dolphins game. One of the fans here is Julie Carr. She's fully vaccinated and loves the mandate.
I think it's just a smart thing to do.
Carr is a nurse in nearby Pahrump, Nevada, and takes COVID-19 seriously. She thinks the mandate might even convince some unvaccinated people to get their first shot.
Raider fans are diehard fans, just like in any other sports thing.
and they're going to do what they have to do in order to come.
That's a gamble the Raiders are betting on, too. If unvaccinated fans show up today and want in, they have to get a shot first. Outside the stadium, there's a big white tent where medical workers offer the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines. Some aren't too happy about it.
I am against it. I think it's wrong.
Tia Fackrell just got her first jab, and she's watching a long line of other unvaccinated fans filtering in.
I think we all look like a bunch of cattle being herded in here to be branded.
But she didn't want to give up her season tickets, and that seems to be the prevailing mood here. Unvaccinated fans begrudgingly getting their first shot. People like Danielle Hall.
If it wasn't for this game and to watch it with my husband, I probably would never have got it. I'm not gonna lie.
Hall doesn't believe the vaccine is very effective, but she also didn't want to lose the money she paid for her ticket. They can cost hundreds of dollars, and the team isn't issuing refunds anymore for unvaccinated folks. Hall tells me she doesn't like the mandate.
It should be up to people whether they want to do it or not. It shouldn't be like pushed to just so you can watch their game. I don't think it's right.
Do you think you'll get your second shot?
No, I know I'm not.
Just the first one to get into the game.
That's it. That's all he's going to get from me.
And this shows one of the holes in the Raiders' mandate. The Pfizer and Moderna vaccines require a second shot, and there's no follow-up if a fan like Hall doesn't attend another game. The team is allowing partially vaccinated fans inside the stadium so long as they wear a mask as well as a yellow bracelet, like the one on the wrist of James Hansen.
I think this is called the band of shame because you haven't got them all yet, so you got to walk around with this.
This is actually Hansen's second dose of the vaccine. He got his first dose back in March, but broke out in a rash afterwards. It scared him. But then this summer, he saw that younger unvaccinated people were getting sick and even dying from the Delta variant. And that scared him even more. The Raiders requirement was the push he needed.
My buddy gave me a ticket to the Raiders game, and I thought to myself, you know, I can just get this shot and get it over with. I did it, even though I still didn't realize it's not good for another 10 days. I still have to wear the band, but it's done, so.
About 600 people have received a shot here since the season started 3 weeks ago. Despite some grumbling, vaccinated fans are filling the stadium, and their sound is deafening. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Nate Hedgie in Las Vegas.
Come back, we'll bring you part two of our series on drought. This is Open Spaces.
This time on the Modern West. The story of pandemics for Native Americans started the moment European colonizers stepped foot off their ships.
They had these really twisted values about who gets sick and who deserves to live and who deserves to die.
The Great Dying. It's part one of our series, Shall Furnish Medicine. Find the Modern West under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org, sponsored by Sheridan Travel and Tourism.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. A select committee is looking to make it easier for cryptocurrency miners to set up shop in Wyoming. Crypto mining is the process of gaining cryptocurrencies by solving equations with the use of high-powered computers. Cooper McKim speaks with the chairman of the Select Blockchain Committee, Senator Chris Rothfuss of Laramie, on why the state is so interested in getting their business.
I think it's part of our overall effort to try to make Wyoming blockchain and financial technology friendly and develop a framework for regulation that enables rather than prohibits activities in this space. And obviously, at this point in time, cryptocurrency mining is a big part of blockchain and cryptocurrency development. We recognize that Wyoming is energy rich. We produce far more energy than we consume in Wyoming. But when we consume it for purpose in Wyoming, it actually ends up providing more revenue to the people of the state of Wyoming and is one of those value added economic diversification processes that honestly helps us pay for education and the roads and all of the other needs that we have, healthcare, We're obviously struggling to diversify our revenue in the state, so anything we can do to achieve that is going to be a positive.
So this seems like a multi-step process. There's obviously, Wyoming's in an energy-rich state, as you said. It could provide revenue, but it's not an easy A plus B equals C, it seems like. So how does revenue theoretically come from this?
The easiest and most direct way is that we do have sales tax on power consumed in the state of Wyoming, where we end up exporting that sales tax out of state. The consumption of power in Wyoming that is produced in Wyoming is actually very revenue positive for the state and the people of Wyoming. It's one of the few sectors where we have a sufficient number of taxes in place that we benefit from it. If that power is leaving the state for consumption, then it's all right. We tax a little bit, but certainly not as well.
So utilities made it sound like there's a lot of potential. They're getting a lot of interest. So what's holding them back from being able to provide that power to some of these miners and getting more of them here?
Wyoming's regulatory structure for power production is very complicated. We are a regulated state. And as a regulated state, our Public Service Commission is statutory obligated to do what is in the best interest of the rate payers, the people of the state, effectively. It's a very complicated process then, weighing what can be added to that rate base, what new power can come online, what new transmission can be incorporated into that. So for the power providers, it's not as easy as just negotiating a rate with a consumer and charging that rate. The overall regulatory structure leads to some challenges, I think, for our power providers, where their price ends up being a little bit higher than some of the states that are less regulated, Texas being an example. So there are always trade-offs, and one of those trade-offs is slightly higher cost for Wyoming based on the integration of that structure.
Okay, so we've heard the big barriers. What is the next step to get past them and get to the opportunity, start improving the system and getting miners here?
What we suggested through the select committee was, let's try and explore the idea of deregulated zones with regard to power purchase and find out what we can do while maintaining our traditional regulatory structure, but recognizing that there might be circumstances and use cases where a direct purchase that is outside of the traditional regulated structure may make sense. Now, we have to do that in a way that doesn't hurt the ratepayer, doesn't hurt existing consumers of power, nor producers of power in the state of Wyoming, and maintains the current existing balance. So I think there's going to have to be a lot of thought and a lot of further discussion.
Okay. So it sounds like there's still a lot of work, but you feel like the state is making some headway towards attracting these folks?
I think we're already pretty attractive, honestly. When I say that we're a little overpriced, I mean a little overpriced. And the low-cost power that's out there is drying up, right? It's sort of the low-hanging fruit concepts. Where there are places where you can get this ridiculously low-cost power, there's going to be a consumer that immediately snaps that up. And that's not an endless supply. So as you have cryptocurrency miners looking for places to locate, they're going to be considering a lot of different factors, price being the lead driver. But as that market for the lowest cost saturates, that next tier is where I think Wyoming is probably already attractive. At this point, we are attracting some in the crypto space, but a lot of it is still exploratory.
Great. Well, that was State Senator Chris Rothfuss. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it. Take care. We'll be right back.
The West's historic drought is changing how people think about water. Last week, we heard about some of the more labor-intensive ideas to help solve or at least ease the drought. This week, Wyoming Public Radio's Ivy Engel explores some potential water policy changes.
Among the possible policy changes is one favored by economists: water markets.
Economists love markets, of course, because it allows us to create value.
That's Jason Shogren. He's an economist, and he says a water market would really help with supply problems. According to Shogren, in a water market, people who own rights to water, like farmers, can buy more as needed. Say, for example, if they're growing a really thirsty crop. Or they can sell their right to their water to others who need it, like cities. He says this would create a fair going rate for an acre foot of water. The challenge is finding the right price.
It becomes more difficult to think about prices for natural resources, like what is the right price for a gallon of water? What is the right price for an ecosystem service? What's the right price to protect an endangered species that lives in that water?
Even if you could figure out a fair rate, Shogren says you have to make sure you can get water to everyone who needs it, not just those who have a lot of money.
So there's the classic trade-off between efficiency, which is making the economic pie as big as possible, and equity, who shares and what share do you get of that economic pie. So markets of themselves shouldn't be considered the king.
He says you have to take specific action to make the market more equitable, maybe by creating something like subsidized low-income water. But then you have to make sure that's not abused.
As long as you can prevent that, then you can be both equitable and you can allocate resources more efficiently.
Shogren admits a market between states would be difficult to set up because laws and regulations over water ownership are different from state to state. But water markets are already in small-scale use in a couple places and have been shown to be effective at distributing water. But you can't have a water market if you don't have access to water to distribute, especially in the West, where a majority of the precipitation falls during the winter as snow. Capturing that moisture and saving it for later is really important. That's where reservoirs come in. According to Dr. Tom Minkley, dams and reservoirs are basically water bank accounts.
And so they're put in for one of two reasons, mainly for irrigation and flood control. You know, let's say you have a 2 or 3 year long drought, you can store water, distribute it, and still have production on the landscape.
Minkley is a professor at the University of Wyoming who studies water in the West. He says dams and reservoirs are especially important during droughts. But just like a bank account, you can't keep making water withdrawals and not adding more to it.
The problem that we've encountered is since around the year 2000, we've mostly been in water deficit conditions. Commonly, we would call that a drought. And so we haven't been adding to that bank account of water.
And not only are these reservoirs being used for irrigation and drinking water, but the dams holding some of them in are producing hydropower. That means those reservoirs have to stay at a certain level to keep producing electricity, which leads to other reservoirs upstream having to be drained. And to make it even more complicated, according to the Colorado River Compact, not all of a state's water stays in that state. The states in the Upper River Basin are contractually obligated to share a certain amount of their water between each other and with those in the Lower Basin. They use Lake Powell and Lake Mead to do that.
And so at Lake Mead, that's kind of where the distribution of a lot of water happens: Arizona, a little bit to Nevada, and California. So Lake Powell is our bank account, and we're trying to, you know, put a couple coins in there, keep it up high enough so that we can maintain our obligations downstream.
And according to Minkley, the compact was created in 1922, when the West was in an unusually wet period, with no thought to the droughts that the West was known for, even at the time. As droughts started to become problematic, it became clear a new management strategy was needed. Minkley says that time is coming fast. The current version of the compact expires in a few years.
And so now we're coming up on the new negotiation in 2026, but the conditions are changing faster than the people who are going to negotiate for those new conditions want to deal with. That's my citizen's opinion.
Both Shogren and Minkley agree that as climate change makes droughts longer and more intense, there needs to be change.
whether that's in the form of a new treaty, water use restrictions, a water market, or even an infrastructure plan. But for the most part, they agree that the change will have to come as we just learn to live with and adapt to climate change and long, intense droughts. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Ivy Engel.
Coming up on the program, the issue of missing and murdered Indigenous women has gotten a spark following the national media attention of a white woman. We will have an in-depth discussion on the topic in just a moment. This is Open Spaces.
This time on Kids Ask Why, Sophia learns about fires in the Mountain West.
What do you think a bird would do if they saw or smelled fire?
They'd probably fly near the mountains where it's snowing.
While Taff finds out why hunting is important.
I learned a lot about what deer do for us and what happens to them.
Find the episode at kidsaskwhy.org or wherever you get your podcast.
This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. Last month, Gabby Petito was found dead in the Bridger-Teton National Forest. Her case received immense media coverage. That sparked conversations throughout Indian country regarding missing and murdered Indigenous women's cases and their comparable lack of coverage. Eastern Shoshone citizen and Wyoming Public Radio reporter Signe McAdams sat down with the Wind River Reservation's Tiana Wagon and Erica Lamebear to share a meal and talk about how this discrepancy felt looking back on the loss of their own family members.
I brought you two specifically to come talk with me and share your stories, and I wanted to see if you would introduce yourselves and why you have such a voice and a strong reaction to, you know, everything that was covered in Gabby's case in comparison to what I say is our own, because these are our cases.
My name's Tiana Wagon. I'm 24, was born and raised here in Riverton, Wyoming. I'm enrolled in Northern Arapaho. I have 7 sisters, and out of my mom's 5 children, unfortunately, 2 of my oldest sisters have passed away.
Tiana's oldest sister, Jocelyn Watt, and her partner, Rudy Perez, were victims of a double homicide in Riverton, Wyoming in 2009. The case is still open, and no arrests have been made. Tiana's second oldest sister, Jade Wagon, was found murdered in 2020. Her case is still open as well.
I think for me it was really hard, being as though my sister's cases are still fairly new. So it was upsetting to see how much attention it received and so many different people talking about it. And a lot of people were stating, you know, well, she was a blogger and she was loved and things like that. That's why she received so much attention. Whereas myself, like, I knew my sisters were both loved, you know.
Erica Lambert is from the Navajo Nation, but resides on the Wind River Reservation. Her daughter, Tyler, was murdered by her boyfriend in New Mexico in 2019. Her case recently went to court.
I just feel like, you know, she's non-Native, non-Indigenous people. Our tribal organizations are not as organized. They're not allotting a lot of the funding in places where it should be. That was my thinking on it. It was like, we need to get together as a people and start helping each other, because that's what we are. We are all relatives. We are all family.
With Gabby's case, I've seen comments on posts about people saying, old Gabby was left. That's why people shared her story. My sister was left. She had kids. Huh? She had a family that cared for her. Well, her mom reached all the news outlets. We tried. You know, we posted on what we were able to, and nobody cared. She was an adult, is what they said with Jade's case. Gabby was an adult. So I see all these comparisons, but that's what it is, and no one wants to accept it. It's a race issue. It really is. With the media, with how the justice system works, like I said, it's just not fair. But part of me feels like if they just cared just a little bit, or if they just tried a little bit harder, if they posted her story sooner, would have we found my sister alive? Because my mom filed the missing person on January 3rd. She was found the week of the 21st. County 10, K2 News, all of our surrounding areas of Fremont County and elsewhere, they didn't cover her story till that very week we found her. So it was just crazy the amount of attention that Gabby had received. Like my mom had said, you know, she feels for that mom. Feels for Gabby's mom. She knows that pain of burying your daughter, burying your kids before their time. So I just feel like we all need to do better as far as treating each other's lives with respect and loving one another, because life's too short. You don't know when you're gonna go. I never thought I would have lost both my older sisters the way that I did. And it sucks to learn to accept that I have to continue my life like this, as young as I am. And I really believe that the hardest part of it was when I turned 24 this year, because my sister didn't make it to 24. But I come from a strong family, and I know that they're watching over me. But I really hope and pray one day that they're served justice. I'm very humbled to know that we did find my sister Jade, that we buried her in the right way. Because I know a lot of families who've shared their stories, they're still searching. So in that way, I'm very grateful. In a way, I feel that Gabby's case has opened all these doors for people to realize that there is a problem. Unfortunately, in this world, you know, it's always after the fact. Something always happens, tragic or whatever, for people to realize that. Thinking in that aspect of moving forward and not giving up on each other. So it's not just for my sister's cases. It's for all, not just Indigenous people. There's a lot of people who have lost their loved ones and haven't been served justice.
So Erica, you've been going through quite a process trying to get your daughter justice. Can you speak about that and also how your reaction was after, you know, having to have all of this going on at the same time that Gabby's case is being reported on and all the coverage that she's received?
You know, I found out this past Monday, Troy had filed an appeal saying 20 years was too long for what he had done to her. And I don't think that's right.
And now I'm raising her son. He turned 5 on the 23rd, and this is his second birthday that she had missed. And, you know, this was his first year of school. She missed it. And it was upsetting at the trial that they were saying Troy was a good kid. He wished his mother a happy Mother's Day this past year. Can my daughter do that? No. And she, you know, she still has the luxury of seeing him. Even though he's in jail, she can write to him. She can call him. All I can do is go to a graveyard and stand by her graveside. What makes me mad the most is, you know, I do feel for Gabby's family. You know, unfortunately, they did find her the way that they did, but the way that law enforcement is just so swift to find her boyfriend, that they're not, well, I'm not sure they know for sure, but, you know, supposedly killed her. And it's like, why didn't my Navajo Nation say, oh, okay, Tyler named him. Let's keep him in jail. Let's keep him because he did this to her. They were going to let him go. But they are on a manhunt for the guy that killed Gabby. And that's really upsetting. And we just need the resources and the facilities and also the personnel that know how to do this. Maybe it's just tribal and it's taboo to talk about. But, you know, times are changing and we need to change with those times. Because, you know, it is an epidemic that's happening. You know, it happens every day. You know, women go missing every day. And like Tiana said, you know, we report them missing, but when does it come out into the news? The community needs to have some place for these people to go. Like, even if it's just like a little tiny office that they can go to, where even if, you know, if it's like donation based only, you know, to help, you know, even like, if an older generation has missing kids, you know, at least to have computers to get them access to social media, to get out these missing people flyers, or to print them out possibly for them and to point them in the right direction to where they need to go, or at least have a victim's advocate on standby for the tribe. That's one of the main reasons why I'm going to school for criminal justice right now. I'm taking these classes and I'm realizing there's a lot of loopholes and a lot of laws that kind of help but do not help, especially when it comes to the reservation, because we are on a sovereign nation and that totally works just like almost the opposite as if you weren't on the reservation. So there's a lot more red tape, a lot more jurisdiction, a lot of more things that you have to go around, but people don't know that. They don't know that there's red tape here, or, you know, there's jurisdiction here, there's certain people that you need to talk to here. But we just need a victim's advocate to help these people, to help navigate them through what they're going to go through, because it's a lot. It is. Like she said, you need to be put in our shoes because you do not know how frustrating it is. I mean, I could tell her, well, why don't you go there? And she does. And, you know, you get stonewalled sometimes.
You're nodding. Did you have the same experience mm-hmm. with all your sisters?
Yes. I feel like it needs to stop being viewed as a secrecy. I think it should be made out to the public. I mean, there's tutorials on how to make a video, you know, can you have like a step-by-step process how to call this person, okay, like a diagram somehow, okay, this happened, yes, okay, this person, so you talk to, you speak with so-and-so, okay, and updating it. I know there's, with any job or program or whatever it may be, there's so many people, unfortunately, that filters through, okay, well, update it right away, so I'm not calling this person that's no longer there. Okay, can I get updated on that too? Why do I have to wait? I'm the client here, you know, I'm the one that's wanting information. Another part of it too, people who are in these positions, if your heart's not in it, get out. If you don't have the heart to be there for another person, which takes a lot, I get it. I totally understand. But if you're not going to help me and you don't care and you kind of just shrug your shoulders, what's the point? How do I know this information that I told this person is going to be related to the right person? Or is that person, oh, they called again, rolls their eyes. So I think it's picking the right people. Funding is another huge issue. I know that. And so, and then just the means of providing. So if it was a donation, Native people come together, you know, and are able to be unified. We just need to bridge that gap of being scared to help out one another and not be so judgmental, whether drugs or alcohol are involved or not. You know, I always say, like, you don't know that person's story. You don't know what put them over the edge. You don't know why that person's choosing to drink. You don't know these things. Care. This world's ugly enough. Yeah. So it's like, can we not care what color we come from? You know, or who's your parents? Or, you know, what background are you? It's just more so like life matters and it's really precious.
Tiana works in Riverton, providing student support services to Native American students, acting as a liaison between families and the school district. Erica works in gaming as an auditor and is currently studying criminal justice and practicing for the bar exam on the Wind River Reservation. Both women continue to be a voice and advocate for MMIW.
That was Wyoming Public Radio's Signa McAdams speaking with Tiana Wagon and Erica Lehmbeer. Remember, if you have an idea for a segment on this program or some comments, you can submit them online at wyomingpublicmedia.org or via social media. When we come back, there's controversy surrounding a climbing project just outside the Wind River Reservation. This is Open Spaces. This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. Sinks Canyon State Park officials are looking at installing a climbing aid to the walls of the canyon to entice more summer climbers. Taylor Stagner reports that the tribes on the Wind River Reservation were not contacted appropriately.
Sinks Canyon State Park officials are looking at installing a climbing aid to the walls of the canyon to entice more summer climbers. The climbing aid's official name is called a Via Ferrata, where climbers can take guided trips scaling the walls of Sinks Canyon. The term is Italian for iron path, but while the plans for the Via Ferrata have been in the works since summer of 2018, the tribes who have historic ties to the canyon have not been adequately consulted. Crystal Reynolds is with the Northern Arapaho Tribal Historic Preservation Office, and she says the first time she heard about the Via Ferrata was August 16th of this year. And after looking around her office and not finding a letter that initiates tribal consultation, she went to a public meeting about the Via Ferrata and asked where that letter was.
Oh yeah, it was sent out, was the response I got.
After a few more weeks, the Northern Arapaho TIPO office has been in more direct contact with those involved with the Via Ferrata project, but Reynolds keeps hearing that their office was consulted.
And the more we keep asking, the more we just keep getting told that the letter of tribal consultation was sent out and that we were consulted with, and we never came to the table.
Reynolds says that Sinks Canyon was originally part of the Wind River Indian Reservation, but was removed by the federal government in the 1870s. Projects like this traditionally require notification.
I mean, they're literally putting the Via Ferrata right off the border of the reservation. So if this is our reservation and that whole area used to be part of the reservation, one of the first things they should have done was consulted with us.
Reynolds says that her office needs to conduct a cultural resource inventory, a practice that uses oral traditions and elder knowledge to better understand the spiritual and historical importance of land before a project like the Via Ferrata begins. Chris Floyd with the Wyoming Office of Outdoor Recreation is with the Via Ferrata project. Floyd maintains that the emails were sent to include the Northern Arapaho TIPO office.
The steering committee did include the TIPOs from both tribes. And so that meant that they were on every email. They were invited to every meeting, whether public meeting or steering committee meeting, throughout the process. To my knowledge, the Northern Arapaho did not engage much until the very last meeting.
Floyd goes on to say that there will be more projects through the Sinks Canyon Master Plan using American Rescue Plan Act funding, and that he hopes that the tribes send representatives to future meetings.
Yeah, we're going to have to try even harder than we have in the past to try to engage with both tribes when these types of recreational projects come up.
Floyd said that the Eastern Shoshone Tribal Historic Preservation Office had put him in contact with an elder of the tribe and that no concerns were brought up then. However, Josh Mann, the director of the Eastern Shoshone Tribal Historic Preservation Office, said via email that the only official meeting with the office was in 2019. He said that there was a casual visit about areas of interest to the tribe that Mann would not consider to be a cultural resource inventory. In June, the state archaeologists conducted their own cultural survey on the proposed site at the time and posted on their website, quote, "No cultural materials were identified during the survey and there are no previously recorded cultural properties on or adjacent to the trail," end quote. But Reynolds with the Northern Arapaho TIPO office says that cultural resource inventories include aspects of oral traditions that were not written down anywhere that the state would know about.
And that's something that professional archaeologists and CRM firms don't have access to, like tribal members. Tribal members don't tend to share those very willingly, kind of our history. You know, we like to keep those recorded within the tribe, or a lot of oral history stay within families.
Chris Floyd said via email, as of this week, the Via Ferrata's final location is undetermined and that there will be another cultural survey conducted where there will be tribal and community input. Lander State Senator Cal Case says he is not impressed with the clip at which the state has pushed through the master plan for not only the Via Ferrata, but a series of other projects as well.
And in fact, the master plan implementation will have more implications for what happens on the ground with respect to cultural and archaeological resources. So it's might even be a bigger deal than, I know it's a bigger deal than the Via Ferrata itself.
He says he's been in talks with the Eastern Shoshone TIPO office to flesh out responsibilities of the National Historic Preservation Act, Section 106, that requires consultation between federally affiliated projects and tribal entities.
I can tell you just, Sinks Canyon has an astounding history of native peoples. And it has cultural and other significance to this day for Native Americans, for both tribes. And that meets the criteria of the 106 involvement. Not that it is on the reservation or Native American land, but that it is culturally important to Native Americans.
Currently, it is unclear if the National Historic Preservation Act will be in play. It all depends on the final proposed location of the Via Ferrata on the canyon walls, but since most of Sinks Canyon is either federal property or was purchased with federal funds, the National Historic Preservation Act protections will probably be implemented. In an effort to improve communication, Case says he plans to introduce legislation in the next session to address the lack of opportunity for the tribes to comment on such sensitive issues. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Taylor Stagner.
Taylor Stagner is a former reporter for Wyoming Public Radio. She currently resides in Montana, where she reports on Native American issues for Yellowstone Public Radio. We thank her for that contribution. Thanks for listening to Open Spaces. The entire show can be found on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org or at all the usual podcast places. Individual segments are on our website and throughout social media, and a reader is our digital editor. Next week, we will bring you an interesting Kids Ask Why episode surrounding COVID-19. Thanks again to all of you who took a moment to become members of Wyoming Public Radio in the last week, and a big thanks to those of you who specifically supported Open Spaces and our Wyoming news coverage. And if you forgot to donate, just go to wyomingpublicmedia.org. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.